All right, well, we're in Leviticus 11 to 15 tonight, so we're going to cover this next section of Leviticus chapter 11 to 15. And really the big theme of this little section is the holiness of God. And we know from scripture that God is holy, but we don't always quite know what it means to be holy. What is that actually, what does this strange word mean, holy? And it means a number of things kind of collected together. It means that God is set apart. He's set apart from sin, but he's also set apart from creation in the sense that he is not part of it. He is the creator of it, which means that he is unique. He's unique in the sense of he's the eternal one, the one that's in control, the all-wise, the all-powerful one. So he's unique. So again, he's separate, he's clean, he's distinct, he's pure. And all of these things come to mean the word which we have in the English language, which is the word holy. God is the essence of goodness itself, and he is unique. So set apart, good, and unique are really the three words that we can use in the modern English to bring together this word of holy. Set apart, good, and unique. And what that means by God being holy is that the space around God's presence is holy as well. So God, where God is, where he manifests his presence, that space is also holy, which means then that the Eden space, the space that we saw in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2 and 3, that space, because it's the place where God decided to show up on earth, is a holy place. It's where God shows his presence. So that's a holy area. It's a set apart area. It's unique. And it's full of the goodness of God. And that means that the people who live in that area, they're supposed to be holy as well. So they're supposed to be set apart. They're supposed to be good. They're supposed to be unique and distinct from the rest of the world because they're living in this holy space. And as we dive into the book of Exodus, we see this theme that continues to come up. So if we go to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 5, Exodus 3 verse 5, where Moses comes out as the shepherd onto Mount Horeb, which becomes Mount Sinai. And as he gets to the top, he sees the burning bush. He's like, what is this burning bush? It's not on, it's like on fire, but not burning. And he walks towards it. And a voice comes from the burning bush and says, do not draw near this place. Instead, take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. It's set apart ground. It's unique ground for a specific thing. And then we get to Exodus 15. Where Moses brings the people out of Egypt, and he prays this praise, the first song of praise in the Bible, where Moses says, "You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you've redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode, your holy dwelling place, which is Mount Sinai, because that's the place where God has shown up in all of his glory." So this holy mountain, this holy abode of God, this set apart, this unique place where God's presence is very manifest. As we go to Exodus 19, verse 6, God says about the people of Israel, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So they are going to be a set-apart nation, a unique people, a good people, different from the rest of the world. And then we go a little bit further. We get to Exodus 26 and verse 33. It talks about this garden tent that we've been looking at in Exodus. And it says, "The veil shall separate for you the holy place from the most holy place." So we have this set apart, this unique place, and then this even more set apart place, because that's the very throne room of God's glory on earth. And that's Exodus 26. The furniture is also holy. So all the furniture that's in the temple or in the tent is also holy, which means it's set apart, it's unique, it's for one use only, and that's for the service of God. Then we get to Exodus chapter 28 and verse 2, and we see what the priest has to wear is holy as well. It says, "You shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty." So Aaron's garments were set apart, they were holy, they were unique. He wasn't allowed to wear them outside of the tent. Okay, there was no such thing as the priest's uniform that he would wear as he went out around the camp of Israel. He was only allowed to wear the specific garments inside the tent. So they were set apart and they were unique for special use in the tent. So that's what we're seeing here as we look through the book of Exodus. We're seeing all of this holy language. which means to be set apart, to be unique, to be distinct, to be good. And that's who God is, and that's what God wants his people to be as they live in that space around him. And so we get on to Leviticus chapter 10, verse 3. Remember, we're moving over now to Leviticus 11 to 15. And just before we get there, what we looked at last week, Leviticus 10, verse 3, God says this. Remember, God allowed fire to kill two of the sons of Aaron. And then he says after that, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, as separate, as distinct, as unique. I should not be treated lightly. And before all the people, I must be glorified. And then again, Leviticus chapter 10, verse 10 to 11, God says to the people, you're distinguished between the holy, or to the priests, you're distinguished between the holy and the common. Okay, so again, this word common helps us to understand what the word holy means. Set apart. Common is just for everyday use. Holy is for specific use, for a single use. And between the unclean and the clean, you're to teach the people of Israel all the statutes that the Lord has spoken to them by Moses. So that's where we are. That's what we're looking at. This idea of holiness. And that's hopefully going to help us as we move into Leviticus 11 to 15. Because this word holy, it doesn't just mean not sinful and the opposite of being sinful. That this is really helpful that we see that in Leviticus 10, verse 10 to 11, between the holy and the common, between that which is pure and set aside for special use and that which isn't. And that's going to help us understand Leviticus 11 to 15. So that will be good for us to understand that. So as we move into Leviticus 11, which is part of what we're going to be looking at tonight, again, Leviticus 11 to 15, verse 44 to 45 says this, I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, which means set apart yourselves, separate yourselves, and be holy. Be set apart, be unique, be distinct, because I am holy. And then he goes on to say, for I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, set apart, distinct, and unique, for I am holy. So they're going to be set apart from the rest of the nations. And what we're seeing here is that the only way to enter the presence of God, the only way to enter the holy space where God was manifesting his presence on earth, was to be holy, so not common, and to be clean. And as God brings the people up into the land of Canaan, they're going to be a special, set-apart, holy people living differently from the rest of the nations, which is why we have some strange commandments here in Leviticus 11 to 15. But what we're about to see in these next few chapters are things that don't necessarily make a person sinful, but makes them unclean. Now, it's really important that we understand this as we read these few chapters. Some of these things don't make you sinful, it just makes you unclean. And being unclean means you're not able to enter that holy space where God dwells. You're not allowed to enter into the garden tent. The person would have to wait a few weeks and go through a few rituals before they were clean again and then able to enter into the garden tent and live amongst the garden people again. Okay, so it's just important that we understand this. There's a difference between being sinful morally and between being unclean is what we're going to look at in Leviticus 11 to 15. So in chapter 1 to 7, we see all the sacrifices. Chapter 8 to 10, we saw the priests. And now in 11 to 15, we're going to be looking at purity, the laws of clean and unclean, holy and common. And I just hope that that's being made really clear as we look at these verses, this passage. So again, if you're not clean, you're not allowed to enter into the garden tent, okay? You're allowed to live amongst the people. You're still an Israelite. You weren't removed from the people, but you weren't allowed to enter the garden space and be in close proximity to God's holiness that was manifest on the earth. One of the other reasons for these commandments, sometimes these strange commandments we're about to look at in Exodus 11 to 15, is because of a promise God made in Exodus 15, verse 26, where he says this, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God, and you do what's right in his sight, and you give ear to his commandments, and you keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I've brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And many scholars believe that a lot of these commandments were actually just simply for the health and physical welfare of the people of Israel. And we're going to dive into some of those as we go today. So the first chapter we're looking at is chapter 11, which is the chapter about dietary requirements and food. And I'm very pleased to let you know that before we read this chapter is nothing to do with us anymore, okay? We are free from chapter 11. We're free from the law. I had all sorts of weird things for the wedding meal today, and I was glad to eat it. I was free in Jesus to eat it. But the people of Israel were bound by these laws we see in chapter 11. So chapter 11 covers a number of things. The first section, verse 2 to verse 8, and then also a few other things in verse 26 to 27, covers land animals, okay? So there's certain land animals, and God's saying, these are the land animals that you can eat, and these are the land animals that you cannot eat. These are unclean to you. You can't even eat them or touch them. And the law for the land animals, where the animal that you were allowed to eat had to divide the hoof, so it had a cleft hoof, and it chews the cud. And maybe there's a few of you are wondering, what on earth is cud? Well, cud is the food that a cow, for example, when he eats the grass, it goes into his stomach, then he regurgitates the grass, it comes back out into his mouth again, he chews it some more, then he swallows it. The word we would use for it today is a ruminant animal, okay? So that's animals like sheep and cows and goats and deer. They chew, it comes back up, they chew it again, and it's finished with. As we go down the list, it forbids animals that eat other animals. So there's lots of reasons about why we shouldn't eat certain animals and why they have to be the ones that divide their hoof and why they have to chew the cud. And many people believe that because it's the other animals were eating things that were unclean, which would have meant disease for the people of Israel, or that these other animals were eating other animals. And so it's a symbol of death, and God wants to disassociate from death because he's the author of life. And then other people believe some of these other animals would have been used in pagan rituals, and so the people were being separated. We honestly don't know. There's lots of speculation, lots of reasons why. Those are a few of them. But verse 2 to verse 8 covers the land animals that they're not allowed to eat and the ones that they are by regulation. Then we move to verse 9 to 11, and we see that the animals of the sea, the water animals, and you're allowed to eat any animal in the water that had fins and scales. So as long as it had fins and scales, you were good to go, slice it up, throw it in the barbecue, and eat away, and give thanks to Yahweh for your meal. And then in verse 13 to verse 19, we have the sky animals. So what we see here is the land, the sea, and the sky. God is the author of all those, the creator of all, so he's the one who gets to tell us what we're allowed to eat, since he made it. But we have the sky animals, and the animals that are forbidden in verse 13 to 19 all seem to be birds or animals of prey, animals that eat other animals. And again, God is disassociating himself from death. Again, we don't have reasons in the text for why God has forbidden these things, but what we do know is that they are forbidden. Then we get to the crawling animals, verse 20 to 23, verse 29 to 30, verse 41 to 42, and all animals that went in all fours, that crawled in all fours and were swarming, they were forbidden, except for ones that had bendy knees. So if you had a bendy knee, an Israelite could eat you. Crickets, locusts, and grasshoppers, and things like that. So that's the rules. Those are the rules for these specific animals. And in verse 24 to 28, and then also verse 36 and verse 39 to 40, we have what happens if I end up touching one of these animals that's dead. You know, sometimes now and then a camel walks across your field, it dies. You have to touch it to get it off your field. What do you do if you touch it? What do you do if it gets in amongst where you're not meant, you don't want it to touch it, but you end up touching it and all these things happen? Well, if you touched an animal like this, you would be unclean until the evening and you just had to wash yourself. You weren't allowed to go to the garden tent. So if you touched the camel that was dead, you touched a rat or a lizard, you had to be unclean until the evening, okay? You weren't allowed to go into the garden tent after touching one of these dead animals. That was the law of God. So again, holy and common used here. And then, of course, we have rules about certain garments. If the garment was something like leather, or if it was dry, a dry item, or if it was a spring of water or a fountain, that's fine. You know, you could wash it and everything was fine. But if it touched a piece of clay or wet grain or touched some of your food or liquid, you had to destroy that. Okay, so God's telling them to destroy it if it touches these certain parts of your daily life. So that's the food rituals. Thank God we don't have to keep those anymore. We're allowed to have our bacon buddies and things like that. But those are the rules for the people of Israel. This was something that they had to concern themselves with on a very daily basis. Chapter 12, we have childbirth and the rules around childbirth when a mother had a child. So when it came to having a son, this might seem sexist in some way, but hopefully I'll be able to explain it so it doesn't come across like that. But in verse 2-4, it's the rules for when a woman has a son. She would be unclean for 7 days, which means she was unclean in the sense of she wouldn't be allowed to interact with anybody. She couldn't touch another person. If another person touched her, they were unclean as well. So she was almost, you can imagine, she had to isolate. Okay, we're very used to that word now. She would have to isolate for 7 days. On the eighth day, she would have her son circumcised. Then after that eighth day, she was free to walk around the camp, show off her beautiful little baby boy to anyone she wanted to. But for 33 days, she was not allowed to go to the garden tent. Okay, she was not allowed access to the garden tent. When it came to a female daughter, according to verse 5, she was unclean for 14 days. And she had to isolate for those 14 days. Then after the 14 days, she could show off her baby to whoever she wanted, walk around anywhere she wanted to go, except for 66 days, she was not allowed into the garden tent. Now, it seems unfair, but remember, the little boy had to be circumcised. So that's the whole thing. There was a circumcision that needed to be done, which shortens the deal a little bit for the boy. And so it's not an unfair scenario here. It's just different things are required. There's a circumcision for the boy, and there's a longer period of waiting for the woman, for the girl. That's all that is. And when you get to the next few verses, verse 6 to verse 8, there's an equality in the sacrifices, which shows equality in male and female as well. So after her 33 days, if it was a boy, or her 66 days, if it was a girl, she would take a lamb or a bird for a burnt offering. And then she would take a bird also for a sin offering. So we've looked at those a few weeks ago. But she would take two offerings, a burnt offering and a sin offering. So a lamb and a bird. If she was too poor to bring a lamb, she was allowed to bring a pigeon or a turtle dove for her burnt offering. Now, trivia question for you. Which one did Mary take into after she gave birth to Jesus Christ? She took a pigeon, she took a turtle dove, which means that she was poor. They were a poor family. Jesus was born into poverty. And the wise men didn't come until a few years after with that gold, so they certainly couldn't be affording a lamb at the time. So there you go. That's the rules for childbirth in chapter 12. Chapter 13 to 14 is all about infections. Your translation might have leprosy. Leprosy might be involved here, but it's not just leprosy. The word here is about all sorts of skin diseases and mold that comes upon garments and houses. So it's an infection that's being spoken about here, an infection that can spread, not just a leprosy that's being spoken about. Chapter 13 deals with diagnosing the leprosy or the infection. Chapter 14 deals with what do you do after someone has been cleansed of it or has been healed of it naturally. So some things to go through here. We have verse 2-8, which deals with if you have a scab or a swelling or a spot on your body that looks like it could be an infection. Verse 9-17 is an actual infection that is spreading across your body. Verse 18-23, if you had a boil that was starting to look like an infection. Verse 20-48 was a burn that begins to look like an infection. Verse 29-37, if you have a spot on your head or a spot underneath your beard that begins to look like an infection. Verse 38-39 is if you begin to have white patches across your skin. Verse 40-44 deals with hair loss. One of my favorite verses in Leviticus says, he is bald, but he is clean. I love that verse. I think it's just fantastic. If he's going bald, it's not leprosy. He's bald, but he is clean. It's very good. So verse 2-46 is dealing with people who have all sorts of things that are wrong with them. And they're like, oh, I think this might be an infection. I'm not sure. So if they think it's got an infection in any of these categories here, what they would do is they would take it to the priest. They would go to the garden space where the priest was, or the, one of the sons of Aaron, and the priest would answer or ask a few questions. Is the infection spreading? Is the hair inside this boil or this burn or this scab or this spot, is it bright white? Does it look like it's deeper than the skin? And if the answer to those questions are correct, like yes, it's spreading, yes, it's white hair, yes, it's deeper than the skin, then he would declare it to be a contagious infection. If he wasn't sure, he would allow 7 days. So that man would have to, again, isolate for 7 days. And then after that 7 days, the priest would check again. And if there was no spread, then he would wash himself and he'd be fine. If it had spread, he would be unclean. He would have a contagious infection. Now, if he had a contagious infection, he had to do a few things. This man would have to do, or this woman would have to do a few things. They would have to tear their clothes. They would have to dishevel their hair and let it hang loose. And they would have to cover their upper lip. All these things are signs of mourning within the nation of Israel. So they would mourn. They would have to cry out as they left the camp, unclean, 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 so that no one would come near them. And then third of all, they would have to live alone outside of the camp. So they weren't just exiled from the garden tent. They were exiled from the nation of Israel. They lived in exile. So go back to Genesis 3. They were removed from the presence of God and God's people. They were completely isolated from all of this. So it really is quite a sad scenario for someone in that situation. Then we move to verse 47 to 58, which deals with garments. If a priest was looking at a garment, someone was like, I think my garment might have a mold that's contagious. And if it was wool or linen or animal skin, and it had red or green mold in it. So if that was the case, once again, you would take it to the priest. Hey, priest, this has got some weird spot stuff coming on it. What do I do? The priest would take it and he would wait for 7 days. If the spread of the greener mold, red or green mold was happening, it would be burnt. If there was no spread, he would wash it, wait for 7 days. If it didn't change, he would burn it. If the stuff didn't disappear, he would burn it. If it began to fade away, you would cut that mold off and you could keep the garment after all. So there you go, some rules about your garments in the book of Leviticus. And then when we get to chapter 14, we look at the cleansing. So if someone was outside, they've been exiled because of their infection, but the infection gets removed from them, it begins to clean up. Now what do they do? Well, there's commandments for that as well in verse 2 to 32 of chapter 14. What would happen was the priest would be called and he would have to leave the tent. He would have to leave the courtyard and leave the camp of Israel, and he would go out into the wilderness to meet this man. And I just love that image of the priest going out to meet someone in the wilderness, which is so like Christ going out to meet us in the wilderness to bring us home. But that's what happened. The priest would leave the camp, go to the person in the wilderness. He would bring with him 2 birds. He would bring with him a piece of cedar wood, a bit of wood. He would bring with him some scarlet yarn and some hyssop. Okay, so again, some weird ritual things were taking place here. What he would do is he would take one of the birds and he would kill that bird. And then he would take that bird and he would allow the blood to go out into a bowl. That bowl would have to be above running water, okay? So again, thank God that we're in the New Testament and not having to do all this. But there would be running water, a bowl, the blood of the animal that had been killed would be dripping into this bowl. Then you would take the second bird with the hyssop and the yarn and the wood, and you would dip it into that bowl of blood, and you would let that bird go. And that bird leaving was a symbol of the infection leaving the person and going off into the wilderness, never to return again. So a lot of imagery that's taking place here. The Day of Atonement imagery is being used here. With the hyssop, we're seeing Passover imagery being used here. With the cedar wood, we're seeing the imagery of the healing of the water and things like that. The person would be sprinkled 7 times with this blood, with this bloody mixture from the bowl. And then he would be allowed to go back into the space. So this sprinkled 7 times, and then he would be allowed to walk back into the camp, okay? So amongst the people of Israel, he wasn't allowed to go into his tent. He wasn't allowed to go into the garden tent either. He would sit outside for 7 days. After 7 days, he would shave every hair on his body, including his eyebrows, okay? So pretty strict things here. So include his eyebrows. He would wash. He would wash his clothes. And then he would come back into the space of God. He would come back into the garden tent. He would bring with him a number of sacrifices, 2 male lambs, 1 female lamb, the grain offering, and some oil. And all of this would be brought to the priest at the garden tent. The male lamb would be offered for a guilt offering. Again, just like before we've read in earlier in Leviticus, blood would be put upon the man's right thumb, the man's right ear, the man's right big toe. And then oil would be poured upon him as well. So separating him from sin, separating him from uncleanness, bringing him back in again. So he is being re-chosen again, because remember he had to go into exile. This oil is symbolizing him being brought back in again amongst the people of God. So all these sacrifices were happening again and all this ritual so that the man could come back in amongst the people of God again after being unclean. So hopefully that was really, really clear for you all. And then then we look at the house. So if your house has got mold in it, verse 33 to 57, which I'm sure maybe has happened to some of you. I've heard in Somerset that ivy is really good for clearing out your mold. But verse 33 to 57, if your house has red or green mold in it, what do you do? Well, according to Leviticus, you would empty your house of all the stuff. You would ask the priest to come. The priest would shut the doors for 7 days. Then he would come back into the house again. He would check and see if there's been any spread at all in the mold. He would remove the stones which the mold was on. You'd have the plaster scraped, and all of that would be put outside the city. And then you would check. You would wait for a few days, and if the mold came back onto your house again, you had to tear down your house. Okay, your house was completely torn down, destroyed. No one was allowed to live there anymore. And if you were living there, you were considered an unclean person, and you had to go through the ritual cleansing. The ritual for cleansing a house was the same ritual for cleansing a person, with the two birds, and one being killed, the other one being dipped, and then cast off into freedom. Chapter 15 deals with fluids and bodily discharges. A little bit gross, but again, we're reading Leviticus. We're reading about bloods and guts and entrails. We're reading about death and sin and all sorts of parts of humanity. So chapter 15 is fluids. I'm going to try and be careful with my words and just use certain words that we can all grasp without going into all the gory details. But when it comes to a man, if a man had an unnatural discharge, verse 1 to verse 15, he was unclean in the sense of he was contagious until the discharge stopped. So he couldn't mix with people, and he certainly wasn't allowed into the garden tent. Once the discharge stopped, he would wash himself after 7 days. So he had to still wait for 7 days. You're seeing that number 7 a lot, I think, as we're reading through Leviticus. So he would be unclean for 7 days. He would wash himself. Then he would offer 2 birds, one for a sin offering and one for a burnt offering. If he had a natural discharge, the procreation discharges, verse 16 to 18, he would be unclean until the evening. So that's it. Just not allowed into the garden tent for that evening. You would have to wash. Then you can go in again the next day. Very, very basic there. For the woman, we see in verse 19 to 24, if it's her natural discharge by the month, then she would be unclean for that 7 days of her natural discharge, simply. Once that's over, just wash. You can go back into the garden tent again. If it's an unnatural discharge, as we saw the bleeding woman that Jesus healed, verse 25 to 30, she would be unclean until her discharge stopped. After that, she would wait for 7 days and then wash, and again offer 2 birds, a sin offering and a burnt offering. That's Leviticus chapter 15. So there you go. That's Leviticus 11 to 15 for you. Lots of stuff, lots of sacrifices and rituals, things we don't have to do anymore since Jesus came and set the Israelites free from the law and never brought us into it, because we are the Gentile people who came into Jesus, not into the nation of Israel. But that's 11 to 15, that part of purity. But what we're seeing here, you might not have any takeaways from this section, but there is a takeaway. And the takeaway is Leviticus chapter 15, verse 31. And it says this: "Thus you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness, when they defile my tabernacle that is among them. So all of this, Leviticus 11 to 15, is literally preventing people from dying because God is in their midst and the holiness of God is in their midst, which means the space around that holiness is holy as well. Therefore, they must not be unclean as they come into that space, lest they would die. Okay, so really important here. So what we're seeing is that God is separating himself from death and from carcasses, separating himself from this mold and fungus, from sickness and infection, and from blood and discharge. All those things that are unclean, that are symbols of death and mold and infection and sickness, God is, as the holy author of life, separating himself from those things and calling his people to separate themselves from it too. And if they're part of it, to not come into his presence. So every part of the lives of the Israelite people was to be impacted, affected, and influenced by the fact that the holy God now lived among them and chose them to be his people. I'm just going to say that again so we grasp it here. But every part of the lives of the Israelite people was to be impacted, affected, and influenced by the fact that the holy God now lived among them and chose them to be his people, right down to what they ate. Okay, for the Israelite people, it wasn't what they did on a Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, and a Thursday evening. It was every single aspect of their life, including reproduction, including sickness, including what they ate on a daily basis, was impacted by the fact that God lived amongst them and they were the people of God. They were called to be the Garden of Eden people, and that changed everything about how they were to live their lives so that the holiness of God wouldn't destroy them in their midst. So that's Leviticus 11 to 15. That's what it's all about. And if you have any questions, don't ask me. No, do. Feel free to ask and I'll do my best to give you a solid answer there. But I hope that's been a help to reread Leviticus in that sense with the garden imagery and understand why.